Coming up today at 1 on Hometown Heroes, this 92-year-old World War II veteran remembers coming ashore on Normandy's Utah beach in June of 1944.
All I could see was dead GIs and dead Germans.
How close did he come to becoming one of those casualties? And what kinds of things did he do as an aviation engineer? We'll also find out how the Central Valley became so central to this Virginia native's life. That's today at 1 on News Talk 580 and FM 1059, brought to you by Humana. Proud to honor our hometown heroes.
This is Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the show where each time we take a trip back in time and hear stories from our greatest generation. We want to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice. We want their stories to be preserved so we don't forget what kind of price has been paid for our freedom. And of course, along the way, as we visit with veterans, no matter how big or how small their hometowns might be, we believe that what they did should be celebrated, and we sure learn quite a bit along the way. We're going to do that today with Melvin Cobb, 92 years old, of Fresno, California. Originally from the Richmond, Virginia area, though, you might detect still a little bit of a southern accent in this 92-year-old's voice. What was life growing up out there in the woods of Virginia?
You didn't have anything, and you once wouldn't have an idea of wanting anything like that, because when I was a kid, I'd like to have a bicycle or a tricycle or stuff like that because other kids had it. Well, it wasn't a thing like that because we had a big farm. We had to work all the time. And my dad, he couldn't read or write, and he raised 9 kids, and everything was nothing but work. He did a lot of fishing, and I did a lot of fishing with him, and did a lot of hunting, and did hunting in daytime. We hunted nighttime, took coons, and anything that we do. And then it was just once was nil. We had whatever we wanted. I mean, we wanted wild turkey for Thanksgiving. We had wild turkey for Thanksgiving.
And when you talk about hunting, you're not talking about for sport. This is to eat whatever you were killing for subsistence. When you got 9 kids, you got a lot of mouths to feed.
Oh, yeah. We raised our own, had our own cows, had our own milk, made our own butter, and we had plenty of deer to eat. We had plenty of ducks, and we had geese, and we had a lot of quail, so our wants was nil. We just said, you know, we had a gun, and that's what we used, and that's what we ate. And we killed our own hogs every year. We always had about 3 of those that we'd kill every year in November, I think, and take it and put it in a shed or whatever it was we had there, and kept it for winter months. So we had plenty of ham and sausage and whatever we wanted, we had.
And you didn't know anything different. I think about the old fable of the country mouse and the city mouse. Being a country boy, did you have any desire to see what else was out there and what this big world was all about?
Well, no, because it wasn't anything, the only thing that I would do, like we had a big 100-acre pond in back of our house that some doctors and lawyers owned in Richmond. And I used to go down there, and they'd stop by my house and pick me up and take me down, and I would paddle them during their, when they were fishing, but it was no boats. It was just a paddle. They didn't use any motors or anything like that.
So you did that to earn some extra change? You paddled the boat while they fished? So you did that to earn some extra change? You paddled the boat while they fished?
I paddled the boat while they fished, and I think, my one, I paddled most afternoon, and I got 25 cents. So from my house to West Point, which was a little town, you could go to the show and get an ice cream cone and Coke for 25 cents. But that was 7 miles I had to walk every day if I wanted to.
How far did you have to walk for school?
Oh, I don't know, maybe a couple of miles, what little bit I did go to school. And I think later on in the years, I think we had school buses, but they didn't come around to the country. They just come out on the highway. So you'd have to walk to the highway to get on the bus at a certain time.
Looking back, thinking about having so many siblings, being in a big family, do you think that had some benefit for you? Did that do something for you that you appreciate now?
Well, yes, because My dad he couldn't read or write, so he just made his living out of the rivers and out of the woods. But your wants was nil. I never had a bicycle or a tricycle. I made my own slingshots and went down in the woods and got the wood to do it with, and that's the way it was. And Sunday, that was Sunday. My dad wouldn't let us do nothing on Sundays. And everything on Sunday was shut down. We didn't go fishing. We didn't go hunting. We never did anything like that. That was his motto and his way of saying that's the way of life.
Yeah, it's that idea of a Sabbath is pretty lost on us these days in this culture. A lot of people can't say like you can what you remember about December 7th, 1941. I like to ask every veteran about the day that Pearl Harbor was bombed. Did you find out right away, or did it take a while for news to spread out there to the woods?
No, they just sent me a card to be at a such and such a place at a certain day.
Oh, you're talking about when you were drafted, but yeah. did you hear about Pearl Harbor when it happened, that America had been bombed?
I've been there a number of times, but we had no way of finding out. I don't think it was any papers bringing to me, because we just didn't live too far in back in the woods.
You mentioned to me earlier before we were on the radio here that you didn't think they'd draft you because you didn't think they'd find you way back there in the woods. How big of an exaggeration is that, or is that the truth?
Well, that's the truth.
How many boys from your family ended up serving in the war?
I was the only one.
So when you got that draft notice in 1942, what was your reaction to it? What did it mean to you?
It meant that I had to go to the service. There wasn't no such thing that you think you're going to go. You went. Oh, you wish you had gone if you didn't. But no, it was just something that happens, and that was a way of life for me. None of my other brothers went at that time, but because they all had jobs, and I think working for the government or something might have had something to do with keeping them out of there. But I was the youngest one out of the four.
And I would have thought, you know, just listening to you describe your childhood and all the different critters that you shot with a gun, that the Army would put that to use and put you in the infantry or something like that, where your rifle eye could do some good. Did you expect to go in the infantry? How is it that you ended up an aviation engineer?
Well, I had been taking my basic training, and this is where I took my basic training out here at Hammer Field. And they had you'd have a bunch of questions to ask that they would ask you, and you'd write down as to what you want to be or where you want to go. What I put down, I guess, is that's where they sent me, you know, to be aviation engineers.
They sent you here to Fresno. In fact, we're pretty close. Your home is not too far from Hammer Field, as it was then in 1942, what is now the Fresno Yosemite International Airport. What was Hammer Field like back then?
We had thousands of GIs here. They even had big two-story buildings where they, you know, have a top and a bottom. I think I got here just before Thanksgiving, and then I think I left later in March or April. They shipped me back east to New York, and that's where I went overseas.
Being around that many people, was that an adjustment for you, having grown up with such a rural existence?
Well, it was something. I don't know whether you call it excitement or not, but, you know, we was always going out shooting guns, getting practice, and taking exercise. That was every morning. You never miss. Then if you want to take our guns out and shoot them, we'd put all our bunks up in one side, and we'd get up if it was raining. Then we'd get out there on the floor and do practice on the floor with our guns and stuff.
And some people might be putting two and two together here as they listen to you. They say, well, he's from Virginia. It was the military that sent him to Fresno, to Hammer Field, to train to be an aviation engineer. But yet he still lives in Fresno. Something must have happened there. I guess it's a good thing that you got sent to Hammer Field, because otherwise you never would have met your wife. Tell me about that.
Well, she belonged to a sorority-like thing, and they could invite GIs. They'd have their own place to go where they would go dancing, so they would take us to the dances. Like we had one big ballroom there in Fresno, and I think it's still there.
Was that the Rainbow Ballroom?
Rainbow Ballroom, and we'd go there and dance, and then we had friends. So we used to go there. If we didn't go there, we'd go someplace else where we could just dance. It was just an ongoing good thing for, you know, being here, and and getting training, and that was the only way we got to do something would be up to the girls that you know, would take us different places to go dancing at night times. We was out here at Hammer Field, and we were invited to invite some girls for Thanksgiving. But anyway, I invited her over to Hammer Field to have dinner with me and other kids there.
You wouldn't be here that long because Uncle Sam needed you to move on to the East Coast. But when you left here, did you have a feeling you were going to see her again? Did you say anything about that?
Well, you know, I figured, well, this is it, you know, because she was really a wonderful, wonderful girl. She wrote to me every day while I was overseas, and I never missed a day from not getting a letter from her. Sometimes it'd be 2 or 3, 4 days a week before they would catch up with us because we were going all the time.
Between the time you said goodbye to her in Fresno and the time you saw her again, I know you went through quite a bit. What kind of training did you receive to be an aviation engineer? What were the things that you had to know how to do?
It just was a laboring thing, I would say. We built that big runway in England, two of them. One was a mile and a half and a mile and three quarters. And 175 feet, and all it was all concrete, and they had what they call hard stands. When the pilots were coming off of a mission, they could have room enough for pull off so the other one could go and pull off, you know. But it was all concrete, and it's there today.
That sounds like a pretty big job. What did you have to specifically do yourself?
Well, we just had to have trucks come along, and I have to throw up 100-pound or 200-pound sacks of concrete. They load the truck up with so much dirt, sand, and you pour that on, and the truck would take off and get it wet and take it out onto the runway. And they had what they call like a streeter. It was made like railroad tires. You'd put that down, and it would be so wide. And then that thing would work automatic. You'd get on those two things and go forward, and you'd drive it. And that would smooth the concrete out as it went along. We did that for 12 months and was somebody there before we got there.
So you spent 12 months in England. How much of a taste of the war did you get while you were in England? Were you aware of what was happening? Were there things you saw that you'd never seen before that opened your eyes a little bit?
Well, just having Germans flying over every night. There never was a night that we didn't get some Germans flying over bombing England. It was that way, but you never had any night lights any time. In London, we didn't live right in London, but with no lights anywhere in London when they'd come over. And they had these here flares, like, they light up. And the way they could find out where they wanted to bomb, they'd come over and drop those flares, and wherever those flares come down, that's where they would bomb, do their bombing. And they really tore it up.
What was it like to see the effects of the bombing and to see the devastation that could wreak?
Well, it was just, you know, places that you could go and see where where the bombs dropped and where they tore it up. It was just unreal to know that they could do stuff like that.
And as you're spending all this time in England, were you aware that eventually you guys would be crossing the channel?
No, not at that time. No. I guess we got our words through company or whoever it was that we had to get ready to go to build runways for all the fighter planes because we were right behind the infantry most of the time because every time they would go and clear a way for us and give us the okay when to go in and get out and get going.
I want to hear about what you saw when you came ashore in France, but first, we need to step away for a moment. When we come back, 92-year-old Mel Cobb takes us back to Utah Beach in June of 1944. Hometown Heroes will continue right after this. Our World War II veterans deserve a chance to see their memorial in Washington, D.C., and you can help send them there simply by renting a car. Between now and the end of October, visit any Enterprise Rent-A-Car location from Bakersfield in the south to Tulare, Visalia, Hanford, Selma, Fresno, Madera, Merced, all the way north to Sacramento. Tell them you heard this ad on Hometown Heroes, and Enterprise will donate 10% of your rental to Central Valley Honor Flight. Restrictions may apply. I'm sure you're familiar with Enterprise, but do you know why the largest car car rental company in the U.S. is called Enterprise? The company's founder, Jack Taylor, was a decorated F-6F Hellcat pilot in World War II, flying off the deck of the Big E, the aircraft carrier USS Enterprise. Maybe I should get him on the show sometime and he can tell us how he earned the Distinguished Flying Cross. In the meantime, choose Enterprise for your next rental. Tell him you heard this advertisement on Hometown Heroes, and you'll be helping to send our World War II veterans on one more tour with honor. They say a picture is worth a thousand words, but when it comes to making my mouth water, I don't need a thousand words, just two of them. Mongolian beef. Okay, two more. Ming's restaurant. And I guess if you want to know where to find it, I should give you two more. Los Banos. That's where I grew up. And I'm guessing Los Banos is somewhere you pass through every now and then. And if you drop in for the Mongolian beef, you might start calling it what I have for years. My favorite place to eat. Period. He may not look old enough for this to be true, but the owner, Paul Sito, has been working his magic in the kitchen there for 45 years now. It's all delicious. If you're a garlic fan, try the Baja shrimp and thank me later. But the Mongolian beef is absolutely unmatched. The flavor, incredible. The texture, tremendous. I can't do it justice with words. You just got to go taste it. One word of caution, do not go on Monday because Ming's is closed on Mondays. So pick another day, tell them I sent you, and let me know if your taste buds enjoy it as much as mine do. That's Ming's Restaurant, 435 West Pacheco Boulevard in lovely Los Banos, California.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Soldiers, sailors, and airmen of the Allied Expeditionary Force. You are about to embark upon the great crusade toward which we have striven these many months. The eyes of the world are upon you. The hopes and prayers of liberty-loving people everywhere march with you. In company with our brave allies and brothers in arms on other fronts, you will bring about the destruction of the German war machine, the elimination of Nazi tyranny over the oppressed peoples of Europe, and security for ourselves in a free world. Your task will not be an easy one. Your enemy is well trained, well equipped, and battle hardened. He will fight savagely. But this is the year 1944. Much has happened since the Nazi triumphs of 1940-41. The United Nations have inflicted upon the Germans great defeats in open battle, man to man. Our air offensive has seriously reduced their strength in the air and their capacity to wage war on the ground. Our home fronts have given us an overwhelming superiority in weapons and munitions of war and placed at our disposal great reserves of trained fighting men. The tide has turned. The free men of the world are marching together to victory. I have full confidence in your courage, devotion to duty, and skill in battle. We will accept nothing less than full victory. Good luck, and let us all beseech the blessing of Almighty God upon this great and noble undertaking.
That was General Dwight D. Eisenhower on June 6th, 1944. Our guest today, 92-year-old Mel Cobb of Fresno, California, heard that message in England. The words you just heard are printed along with General Eisenhower's signature in Mr. Cobb's exquisitely preserved copy of the history of his outfit, the 850th Engineer Aviation Battalion. 10 days after that order of the day launched the invasion of Normandy, Mr. Cobb and his fellow engineers were headed across the English Channel. What did you encounter when you got to Utah Beach about 2 weeks after D-Day?
It was clear for us because the infantry was ahead of us. Mm-hmm. That was the only way that saved us. We were out in the channel at midnight because we were waiting for the tide to rise, because if the tide rises, those LSTs that they would take off of the ship to go to shore, they wanted the tide up be high enough so that they could go to shore quite a ways instead of waiting for the low tide because it'd be too far out. We hit that about 6:30, I think, something like that in the morning when the tide was high, because it was 25 men, you know, with all the guns and stuff that we had on. We had to carry that with us, and that's the reason they wanted to get us closer to the shore on high water rather than low water.
So what were you carrying as you went ashore?
Well, I had my helmet and my gas mask, my gun, I had 100-and-some rounds of ammunition, and had my mess kit and my clothes, whatever I had.
What did you find? Can you describe for us what that scene was like on Utah Beach when you went ashore?
What could I call I could see was dead GIs and dead Germans. Well, you'd have to see it to believe it. You know, you can have, they can show you pictures and you can and see what's happening there. But when they hit the shore, the guy on the ship put you on those LCTs, and then when you went to shore and you hit the bottom, then they said, all off, and you go. You don't wait. That was the message that we had to get off of that as fast as we could. But just like I say, but we were pretty, I would say, pretty safe maybe because we didn't go right with the infantry. We was right behind the infantry.
So you were safe, but you were confronted with this evidence that not everybody was. What was it like for you to see the bodies everywhere, to experience that scene?
It was so many bombs dropped, and what happens is the bombs were so heavy that it would break the concussion, bladder concussions on the cows and horses and stuff like that. So that's what you would see too, along with 100 dead GIs and hundreds of Germans and the whole bit.
And did that rattle you? Did that make you emotional?
Well, no, you just have to fight and go. So fight and go. It wasn't no holding back. When they tell you to come off that LCT, you came off of it. You wasn't no backing off. You was one way off, one way out, and that was lower the lid and take off. You could find a place where we could stop and, you know, sit down and figure out where we're going to go and where we're going to be and what's going to happen.
And you were, if I do my math right, you were 23 years old at the time. Were you afraid? Were you concerned that you might not come back?
No. We had a job to do. Things are different now. I mean, you know, but there was no way out.
Did you feel that someone was looking out for you? Someone would protect you? Or?
Good man upstairs.
Well, and I ask that because you talked about your father and how serious he was about keeping Sunday as a day of rest for your family and all that. And so that just made me wonder if you had a belief that God would protect you when you were overseas.
Yes. If it wasn't for him, we wouldn't be here.
Well, and I want to hear about some of those things that you experienced that you were fortunate to survive. You came ashore there and you moved through France building runways, but this isn't, you know, naked virgin ground you're building runways on. You guys had a lot of work to do before you could build a runway. What all went into that?
We tried everything. We even put gasoline and oil, laid some kind of felt down for the planes, but that didn't work because the planes would hit it and tear it off. They had built what they call a pierced steel blank. It came in 6 foot by 2 feet wide. And you laid that down, and you had to kind of interlock itself. And then you had to have a little thing that you drove in so when they hit it, it didn't snap out. It was just like a piece of metal. You drove it in there, and that kept it from coming out. That's what we used mostly. In fact, we built one way in Germany with out of red brick, 2 layers.
But before you could even do that part of the job, a lot of times you had to make sure there were no explosives left behind. How often did you go out detecting mines?
Well, that was the first thing you did. You went out with your mine detectors, and then if you found everything all right, then we had bulldozers and stuff like that. Then you had to level the ground, and so it was all took a lot of work in order to get the ground right for the pilots to land.
Well, I'm trying to put myself in your shoes, and I'm just imagining going out in an area where you've never been before with a mine detector, knowing there's a reason you have to use it, that there could be a mine anywhere you step. It seems a little nerve-wracking to me. How did you deal with that pressure?
Well, you just have to be sure, feel sure you got this mine detector that's going to protect you. But you have to know, and they had a way, some of the higher officers had a way of when they laid a mine detector in a group, there was only one way they could do it. Somehow we found out that the way it was, so if you found a mine, then you could probably, just like I say, take your mine detector and go and find the way they had set them out there for you.
You figured out the pattern that they used. And what if you did detect a mine, what would you do next?
Well, we'd have to go there. They have a what they call like a pin light you'd have to put that in there. So if you picked it up, to make sure it wouldn't go off. And the same thing with a lot of the other stuff they had. You had to have a pin there for it to go. Once you pull that pin, and it's just like throwing a hand grenade. Once you pull that pin, you got to let it go. So you had to figure out how to did it. But we had mines there, so we knew what we were doing, knew how to, you know, not set them off.
You knew how to neutralize their trigger mechanism. Do you have any memories of that stand out, of a time that particularly made you a little anxious?
No, not necessarily, because it was a dangerous thing to do. You've never done nothing like that before, but you got your training. You took training to know how to do that kind of stuff before they even sent you in there. If you got there, and if you knew what you had to do and knew how to do it, then it was okay.
What was your rapport like with your fellow aviation engineers, the other guys you spent all this time around?
Oh, we had some wonderful guys. You know, our company was A company, and just like I say, it had a B company, C company, and headquarters. And all the guys, we knew each other. We worked together. We fought together. Everything that we did it together.
How did the pilots treat you guys?
Pilots, you know, they did the job. A lot of them would come back with part of the wings off, or tail lights, part of it blown off. And, you know, it was just an amazing thing how these pilots could take a plane like that and land it. We'd build a runway, and then we'd build a strip for ones that were coming back that would crash when they come back. Then we had a side place for them to land on instead of the runway. If they got one on fire, well, they just pulled it out to the emergency, and some of them jumped out and some of them didn't.
I imagine you spent a lot of time around airplanes?
Yes, yes, quite a bit of time.
Did you have a favorite plane that would come through that if it was coming in for a landing, you just had to watch?
P-51s. P-51s and P-47s, those were all our fighter planes. When the big bombers went on a mission, they would always send some P-51s or P-47s in amongst it with the hundreds and hundreds of all them big bombers going over, because the Germans could get in there with their fighter planes. So that was mainly one of the P-51s and 47s that went in. Whenever they went on a mission, they would take them with them.
That was the reason you had to build those runways, so those fighter planes would have some place to take off and land. But those runways, those air bases throughout Europe, were also targets of the enemy. Were you ever at an airstrip when the Germans came and bombed you or shot at you?
We had literally some kind of huts that we were lived on in. And we always had some place to go because we had meetings every night. And it was just like wooded area, like, and it had big ditches. And a lot of times they'd be coming before we could even get out of there. We'd jump over into those ditches there because they would be dropping bombs, you know.
What goes through your mind when you're huddled down in a ditch hoping the bomb doesn't have your name on it?
It probably had my hand on it. But I'll tell you a little story. We were in France, and we were getting bombed so much because we was still building these runways. I dug a hole in my underneath of my bunk, and then whatever they had would strafe us. Then planes would come over strafing us. I'd put some boards over there and get down in that bunk and stay there until the raid was over with.
Did you ever have any close calls that way?
Yeah, closest one was in a tent. They strafed the tent, and it just like you could take a shotgun and shoot through it. I had bullet holes all full through it. But I was down on the ground, so I was safe, I guess. I don't know.
So you're in a tent, and you're on the ground, or you're under the ground because you dug a hole?
I'm under the ground. Uh-huh. I got my, like, this is my bunk. I'll dig a hole and get down in there and then put some boards on top of it and get down in there while they're strafing.
So they're strafing. You hear the rat-a-tat-tat and all the noise going everywhere, and then it's quiet. You finally come back up and you find your tent full of holes?
Yep. That's right.
What does that do to you?
Another day.
Yeah, you would live to see another day, and I know there are a lot of people who are very thankful for that. We need to take another break, but when we come back, we'll hear more of Mr. Cobb's experiences in World War II, and I'll tell you how you can make a difference in the week ahead. when and where you need to be there to welcome home 70 World War II veterans from an unforgettable journey to the World War II Memorial. Hometown Heroes will be back in a moment, but as we head to break, how about a little music from the time we're talking about? Mr. Cobb discussed meeting his wife dancing in Fresno. A few of you have asked me lately why I haven't played any of those old World War II era songs recently. So ask and you shall receive. More of Mr. Cobb's story when we come back.
Once there was a little girl who lived next to me, and she loved a sailor boy, he was only three. Now he's on a battleship in his sailor suit, just a great big sailor, but she thinks he's very cute.
With his bell-bottom trousers, coat of navy blue, she loves her sailor, and he loves her too.
Sailor boys away on the ocean blue, soldier boys all flirt with her, but to him she's true. Though they smile and tip their caps and they wink their eyes, she just smiles and shakes her head, then she softly sighs.
Oh, bell-bottom trousers, coat of navy blue, she loves her sailor.
When her sailor went to see what he could see, she saw that he ate spinach, now he's big as he can be. When he's home they stroll along, they don't give a hoot, she won't let go of his hand even to salute. If her sailor she can't find on the bounding main, she is hopeful he will soon come home safe again. So they can get married and raise a family, dress up all their kiddies in sailor's dungarees.
Oh, bell-bottom trousers, coat of navy blue, she loves her sailor and he loves her too.
The average age of the veterans on this program is pretty close to 90, so I've seen firsthand over the years the challenges of aging, and I've realized that everybody approaches them a little differently. For some, a friendly senior living community is the ideal option, but for many of us, there's no place like home. I don't have any ruby slippers for you, but I do have an idea. Call Jason Selzler at 317 Construction, recognized by the National Association of Home Builders as a certified age-in-place specialist. Instead of giving up the comforts of home, why not let 317 Construction make your home more comfortable by making it more accessible? Jason and his crew can widen doorways, install ramps for wheelchairs or scooters, reconfigure your counters for better access, modify your shower for safety, secure grab bars wherever you need them, whatever it takes to allow you and your family to keep making your memories in the place that holds so many of them, your home sweet home. Call 905-8490. That's 559-905-8490. If you are a World War II veteran and you have not been to the World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C., Honor Flight wants to take you there free of charge. The sooner you submit an application, the sooner Honor Flight can get you to your memorial. In Kern County or the Central Coast, call Lily Marsh at 661-544-VETS. That's 661-544-VETS. Or go to honorflightkerncounty.org. For Fresno, Madera, Merced, Mariposa, Kings, or Tulare counties, check out CV Honor Flight, CV as in Central Valley, cvhonorflight.org, or call Al Perry at 559-970-9853. That's 559-970-9853. Maybe you're the son or daughter of a veteran and you'd like to go along as a guardian. There are applications for that too, and there are other ways you can help. Donations to Honor Flight are tax deductible. We all owe our freedom and liberty to the men and women who put their lives on the line for it. Let's all come together now behind Honor Flight and give our veterans one more tour with honor.
This is Hometown Heroes, honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting today with a 92-year-old World War II veteran originally from rural Virginia. Mel Cobb was sent to Fresno, California as part of his training. He met his wife Emily on the dance floor during that time and returned to the San Joaquin Valley shortly after World War II. He's been in Fresno ever since. We've heard about some of the work he did with the 850th Engineer Aviation Battalion, constructing strategically important airstrips as they moved across Europe after landing in Normandy 2 weeks after D-Day. To see some photos of the kind of work Mr. Cobb and his fellow engineers did, pull up his photo gallery on Facebook. Just type in Hometown Heroes Radio. So you built runways in England, you built runways in France, you built runways in Germany. We've heard about, you know, your tent getting shot off from on top of you. And I'm curious, too, you guys were not too far from the fighting at the Battle of the Bulge, the famously brutal winter. How did you experience that winter?
It was cold and snowy, and we always had heaters and stuff in there. Well, I had 14, 15 guys that I was in charge of, and that was one built tent. That's what we used to keep warm. Had a heater and put it in and put wood in there, and that's what kept us alive, I guess, from freezing to death.
Are there any other duties that you had that you want to tell us about? I mean, we've heard about going through minefields with the mine detector, removing those, laying down the different parts of runways. Did you ever have to put together any bridges or anything like that? Was there anything else you did?
Well, we went across the Rhine River in Germany, and before we could get across that, they had to use these pontoon, I think, to put them out because that was all blown up, and the bridges was all blown up. And then in the meantime, when we got there, we had some big guns along with us that the Germans would float down, put a mine on the river and float it down. And we had to set up our guns to shoot them if it did come down while we were going through.
Yeah, to shoot the mine in the water so it wouldn't blow up the bridge?
Yeah. Whatever they throw down coming down that Rhine River there, that's what we had to do in order to get across and keep from blowing up our pontoon ridge.
Did you have much of an understanding of what you were fighting for?
Well, at that time, you know, you're talking about fighting for freedom to be in a world where you could live and have what you want and do what you want to do in life. It's a lot of things that people don't realize that they've got a good life and they don't appreciate whatever they have. I was one that really thought into it that it was a right thing to do.
Did you ever have to deal with the loss of a guy that you served with, losing a friend?
Yes, I did. I had a kid that drove a truck for me. He was 19 years old. His picture's in that book. And we were tearing down a big building, and I think some of it was like they used a lot of concrete, and they had put concrete slats on top of the roof, and the bombs had, you know, shattered it all. We was going to go over there, and I had to take my guys and some more guys to go up there so we could take all that stuff off and then redo it. I forgot to get him to bring some water, so I says, you go back to camp and get some water because we're going to need water soon. And he said, well, I want to go around this corner here and go up and see some of the kids up there on top. Well, when he got down there where those guys was, they were dropping down that cement slab stuff, and one hit him right smack on the head, and it folded him up just like a rubber ball. That was an experience I'll never forget. And the concrete was that heavy, it was just like squeezing it together like this. And that was when he was 19 years old.
Well, and I'm glad you shared that, because I think a lot of people just have a very narrow or surface view of different roles in war, and the fact is, no matter what you're doing, it's dangerous work, and anything can happen at any time, and the work you did was certainly important to the overall picture with building the runways and allowing the fighters to do their work, and as that story illustrates, it wasn't without danger. Have you ever found yourself over the years thinking about what that young man would have done with his life?
Well, he lost the best part of his life. He wasn't married, and he had everything going for him as a young kid, 19 years old. And he drove a truck for me everywhere I went. He was my truck driver, and just a good kid. Well, all of our guys were, you know, you can find good and bad in anybody or anything, but they were all a good bunch of people, men, young men. And that was about my biggest thing, to see something like that happen to a young kid.
Yeah, and I don't know if those of us that weren't alive during that time can really understand the magnitude of this, but 400,000 Americans, more than 400,000 died during World War II. That's a pretty heavy price to pay for our freedom. What, when you think back on World War II, what is it that you think those of us who weren't around then and future generations, what should we remember about that time in our history and what all you guys did?
Well, I think to me, you know, people nowadays is take everything for granted. That so what? You were in the service and you did this and you do that. So, but I say that's okay. I did my part, I think. And people today don't realize what it means to have freedom and do what you want to do. And that's always been my way, you know, I mean. You can do things and have things, but still have respect for the people that you know, regardless of who they are. It's getting to the point now where, you know, if you can do something wrong, why not do it wrong and get away with it? And it's not right. It's not right to kill young kids and old people like that one guy, take him and beat him up for what? He's had his life to live. Why not leave him alone? Why would you want to do something like that? But we've got that in this country today, and I never would have believed that this country would be the shape that it's in. Who am I to say, you know? But I know right from wrong, and if I do wrong, I want to be paid for it.
Yes, and hopefully the wrongdoers in that case will be apprehended soon. If you missed it, Fresno, California made headlines this past week when robbers broke into the home of a World War II veteran and assaulted him. Offers of support are pouring in from all over for Joseph Martin, like Mr. Cobb, our guest today. Mr. Martin is 92 years old. He survived the Battle of the Bulge, but in this incident, he lost some priceless mementos from his World War II days in that robbery. Those cannot be replaced, but one of the things I'd like to see Mr. Martin receive is a free trip to Washington, D.C. and the World War II Memorial with Central Valley Honor Flight. Flight number 2 is tentatively planned for March, but the inaugural flight is taking off this coming week, and I'll share a few thoughts on that before we're done today. When you think back on all that you went through, what would you say you're most thankful for?
Think I've had a good life. I had a wonderful wife, bar none. I got a nice son, I have a granddaughter, and I have a great-grandson. So that means more to me than I could ever expect.
Especially when you consider that your son and your granddaughter and great-grandson wouldn't be here if you weren't hiding under those boards that night, huh?
That's right.
You mentioned about coming home and she wasn't your wife yet, but she was waiting for you. I don't know that I asked you about that moment. What did it feel like for you to look over and see her again?
Words can't express it. My brother went to, from where we lived to Richmond, was about 30 miles, and my brother went up and got her and brought her home, and then I went to Richmond, then I find my way back home on the bus. That's when I didn't know it till then.
So you didn't know she was there?
No, I didn't know she was there.
Sounds like that might have been the best surprise of your life right there.
You know, you can go and do and see people and do things, but I don't know. She was just words can't express the love she had for me and I for her. We were married for 60 years.
Well, I want to say thank you for serving our country and thank you for telling us some of those stories. You know, one thing I didn't ask you about, the civilians in France and Germany. Did you mingle with them much at all? Did you get any kind of feeling for how they felt about what you guys were doing there?
We'd see them and that would be it. And we more or less kept to ourselves because you never know what's going to happen, regardless of what people are, who they were, or whether they were Germans or Frenchmen or whatever. You had a lot of respect for them, and they too towards you to do the same. We went through Paris, you know, that Germans had taken Paris, but then we took it back, so we went through Paris on their way to wherever we were going. A lot of people had respect for us, you know. They'd go out jumping out of windows and calling and hollering and thanking us for coming through. And
I imagine that kind of scene as you're going through the streets of Paris and hear these civilians are out there thanking you and doing all that. That probably makes you feel like what you're doing is worthwhile.
Yep, that's right. If it wasn't worthwhile, we wouldn't be doing it.
Simple as that, huh? Well, I hope you at home have enjoyed our conversation with 92-year-old Mel Cobb as much as I have. I said I wanted to bend your ear about Honor Flight before we finish today, and I'm going to take that opportunity now. If you're a regular listener to Hometown Heroes, you've heard off and on about Honor Flight for years. If you haven't seen the documentary on this effort to get our World War II veterans to their memorial in Washington, D.C., you have a great opportunity coming up November 9th in Bakersfield. Honor Flight Kern County, which has been flying veterans from the Bakersfield area and the Central Coast area out to Washington, D.C., will be hosting a screening of this outstanding film. I've seen it a couple times. There is never a dry eye in the house. This is going to be at the Bakersfield Fox Theater November 9th. Tickets are free for World War II vets, $15 for everyone else, and you can get them by calling this number, 661-544-VETS. That's 661-544-VETS. That'll be in Bakersfield November 9th. But this next week, you have an opportunity in Fresno to be part of the inaugural Central Valley Honor Flight. 70 World War II veterans from Fresno, Tulare, Kings, Merced, Madera, and Mariposa counties will be boarding a charter flight to our nation's capital early in the morning on this coming Tuesday, October 29th. If you'd like to get out to the Fresno Yosemite International Airport and help us send them off, try to be out there Tuesday morning about 5:15 a.m. I know it's early, but it'll be worth it. Fresno State Coach Tim DeRuiter, who served 7.5 years in the Air Force, he's going to be there with us to give the veterans an early morning pep talk. We'll start it all off with reveille from a 95-year-old World War II veteran who still blows a better bugle than anybody else I know. So many volunteer hours have gone into putting this together, and so many of you have donated money also. Each one of those contributions has made a difference and helped make this possible. And Central Valley Honor Flight has received large donations from the Educational Employees Credit Union, EECU, the Clovis Veterans Memorial District, Johansson Transportation Service, Farney Automotive Group. The list goes on and on. The Madera Rotary Club, the Tulare Downtown Association. It's been so exciting to see so many people come together from all over in our valley to honor these veterans. And now it's here. It's actually happening. So feel free to join us at the airport Tuesday morning. And even more important, I think, is that you be there Thursday afternoon to welcome them back from this incredible experience. Come to the Fresno airport Thursday at about 4:15 p.m. and welcome these heroes home. You can bring a homemade sign if you want, bring a flag. Most importantly, bring your gratitude for our greatest generation and help show these veterans how much we appreciate what they did for us. You'll be in good company with the mayor of Fresno, a pep band from Fresno State, a bunch of active duty sailors from Lemoore Naval Air Station who are making a special effort to be there. This is the first, but with your help, it will not be the last. Let's make it unforgettable. Thursday, I know it's Halloween, but be there at 4:15 p.m. before you get to trick-or-treat time. I hope you'll take advantage of this historic opportunity to prove to our veterans that you believe those four words I close Hometown Heroes with each and every week. Here they are right now. Freedom is not free.